You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I am an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining us today, we have a distinguished panel of guests, starting with Daniel Dawson, assistant professor at Purdue University, and most importantly, co-host of the Book of Nature podcast. Dan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
And also joining us, we have the grand old man of the Christian podcasting world, Nathan Gilmore, associate professor of English at Emmanuel College. Nathan, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, not a problem. I enjoy these crossovers.
And I say thanks for coming on the show as if it's, you know, my show instead of your show, because, you know, you guys are the Christian humanists. So we appreciate it.
Yeah, but right now we're on the City of Man, so I am an alien in this city.
It's like we're it's almost like we're franchises, you know.
Yeah, to, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
The local McDonald's and he's the headquarters.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I should admit, I didn't ask how we're supposed to introduce this. I think this episode will drop first, but as our listeners can probably tell, this is one of our crossover episodes, the yearly thing that we do where we all sort of switch podcasts. Nathan, is there anything in particular I'm supposed to be saying here? We didn't ask last year, and I think it just kind of sounded awkward.
No, I don't believe so. I mean, you know, just a reminder that there will be monster movie episodes on Christian Humanist Podcast, on Sectarian Review, on Christian Feminist Podcast, on Book of Nature. So if you've not subscribed to all of them, and I don't see why you wouldn't, go ahead and do so now, and you can enjoy all of these good monster movie discussions with, you know, again, the scrambled up casts of the various podcasts.
And yet another question that I didn't get to ask last year because we didn't have you on. How did the topic get picked?
As with the first 2 years, it came from the farmers. I think that, you know, Christian Humanist Christian Humanist Headquarters, I often joke, is in Minnesota, and that bears out at least in terms of what our crossovers are. I think that I suggested the Firefly crossover to Victoria, and then she made it happen. And then last year, I think Michael had the idea for the Twilight Zone crossover. And then this year, you know, before I knew what was happening, Michael was sending me a link to a spreadsheet where we could all sign up for the monster movie crossover.
So we're throwing Michael under the bus on that one.
Oh, no. Just noting that, you know, he is the Caesar of our little triumvirate.
Let's assume it's Augustus Caesar, otherwise things don't end well for him.
Ah, true enough.
Yeah, well, with that, we should probably move into our particular monster movie. We will be discussing Dracula, specifically the famous Bela Lugosi Dracula. Guys, what's your first exposure to Dracula in general, and then to this movie specifically? Let's go with we'll go geographically from north to south. Dan, why don't you kick us off?
Okay, so yeah, this is a tough one. I was thinking about this, and to this movie, my first exposure to the movie was getting prepared for this episode. So I had never seen the movie before, but when I found out that we were doing this crossover, and I saw there was a free spot on your show to talk about Dracula, I was like, oh, that sounds good. Let's try that. But as far as introduction to our exposure to Dracula, to be perfectly honest, it's one of the it's sort of just vague memories from childhood that there was this character out there, Count Dracula. And I guess I probably was exposed to the Count on Sesame Street before I was exposed to the inspiration for the Count on Sesame Street, so I guess that might be my first exposure to the whole thing. But I sort of had in back of my mind that there was this, you know, horror character that existed, that it was a fairly old pedigree, but I never really got into any of the lore or any of the movies really that much, except the occasional modern monster movie, which included vampires like Blade and Van Helsing and things like that. But other than that, I just haven't really gotten into any of the any depth up until recently, up until this point.
Yeah, and I'm in the same boat, and not in that I hadn't been exposed to it, but I'm pretty sure my first exposure to Dracula in general was through the old Ghostbusters cartoon, the real Ghostbusters.
Oh yes, great show.
Oh yeah, yeah. We to out myself as a super nerd here, we actually own it on DVD.
Oh, that.
I've been slowly subjecting my wife to it over the years.
Oh man, I used to watch that all the time when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, it's such a great show, and I have vague memories of there being like a Dracula or a vampire episode of some kind, and I'm pretty sure that was my introductory exposure to it. And then after that, I mean, I think the next thing I remember was seeing the Mel Brooks movie Dracula Dead and Loving It, which I watched it and enjoyed it. In retrospect, it's not that good of a movie, so I have since gone back and rewatched it and thought, oh, you know, this movie I really liked when I was, you know, 15 or whatever, really not so good.
Yeah, it seems like that would have been the kind of movie that I would have liked to, would have watched, but I never got around to watching that one.
Yeah, that's been my experience with a lot of Mel Brooks films, is they are a lot funnier when you're 16.
Right. Well, in retrospect, so I had gone back and rewatched Dracula Dead and Loving It and thought, ah, this is just so. But then having rewatched the Bela Lugosi Dracula, I kind of want to go and watch the Mel Brooks one again, because it seems like it is more of sort of a scene-for-scene parody that might be more appreciable having just watched the Bela Lugosi movie, which I had not seen when I was 15 or 16. But Mel Brooks did make me want to go read the book, so I went and read the book Dracula, and absolutely loved it. It's a fantastic book, at least I think it's a fantastic book. And then I went and watched this movie, a couple of years later, and was a little bit underwhelmed for reasons that we'll get into. Since then, I've sort of occasionally kept up with some of the vampire movies that have been released, possibly excluding Twilight, I suppose, but including a lot of the others. Nathan, what's your first exposure to Dracula?
Well, like you two, I mean, Dracula is kind of this atmospheric figure in American pop culture. The breakfast cereal, to be sure. The Count on Sesame Street, like Dan said. As far as my first Dracula movie, I'm pretty sure it was the 1992 Bram Stoker's Dracula, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later. As far as the novel, I was aware of the novel. I still haven't read it. Sometime in college, I watched the movie for the first time, and I mean, I am coming off of the, Coppola film Bram Stoker's Dracula, this one is so subdued and so quiet and has so few scenes that it really was kind of a step backwards. So I kind of recognized it as the source of a lot of what I think about vampires and such, but there wasn't really a whole lot that really impressed me in college. Now going back and watching it again, prepping for this episode, paying attention to it as a film, knowing I'm going to be talking about it on a podcast, I can see a lot of things to commend in the film. The other thing that I would be remiss to neglect, I guess I should mention, there we go. I got lost in my own phrases there, is that, because I was an 80s child, I grew up playing the Castlevania games, first on, coin-op arcade cabinets, and then later on the Nintendo Entertainment System, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think I have vague memories of playing those too, but they must not have made a huge impression on me, because I don't remember them very well.
Well, the first three of them on the old Nintendo Entertainment System I wore out. Then I was aware that, as each progressive console came and went, there were Castlevania games that came out on the franchise, but I haven't played any of them, so...
Was the Nintendo ones, was those the ones that where, like, if you it had a day-night cycle, and if you went out at night, like, the monsters were, like, three times as hard to kill?
That was Castlevania 2.
Yeah. Okay, because I do remember that.
Yeah, one and three were more straightforward, sort of side-scrolling, fight the bad guys, get to the boss kind of games. Number two, though, you're right. I mean, it was a lot more... non-linear in its structure. And yeah, I mean, it's not that the monsters became more difficult at night. It's just that if you went out during the day, you just kind of wandered around and it was an utterly boring landscape. But on the other hand, you didn't get killed, so you had that going for you.
Okay, yeah. Maybe it was something else then that was similar to that, because I seem to recall playing a game like that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry, we didn't really have video games in Montana in the 80s, so, you know. It's,
fair enough.
Yeah, so in terms of the movie, I don't know that it would actually be worthwhile to go over the plot, partially because I suspect just from the culture everyone kind of knows it, but also partially because the movie sort of assumes that everyone knows the plot. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, they seem to really, even when I watched the movie before I started reading the book, and even before I started reading the book, it seemed obvious that there was a lot of stuff that was being glossed over, you know, because I knew it was based on a book, and it was pretty clear, even without having read the book, that there was just a lot of compression going on of the scenes and the plot in general. So
right, and some of that I suspect is because it's not only based on the book, it's also based on the play that Bela Lugosi got his start as a stage actor playing Dracula, and then switched into the movie and then never got to play anything else, at least not very well. But so it's a movie based on a play, which itself, if I remember the sequence here right, is based on a previous play. A previous British play, which was itself based on a play written by Bram Stoker, and only performed once so that he would have the copyright to it. So, I mean, it's this sort of fifth or sixth generation Dracula by the time we get to the movie itself, you know, even though it's only, what, 40 years after the book is published. Mm-hmm. So, it's an odd creation, although it's one that's, again, has clearly affected our culture. But yeah, you're right. They gloss over so much in the movie. You know, they never deal with Lucy, for example, right? She gets turned into a vampire. We're shown that she's out there as a vampire, and then she disappears from screen and we never see her again.
Yeah. And I hadn't got that far in the book. I think I was almost to that point in the book before I, before we start this episode. So, but what I did read, there was a whole lot more going on. So, and that, which is, you know, fairly typical, for movie adaptations of books, but it seems like this one was particularly compressed, I guess is the right word I'm using.
Well, and I suppose before we dig too much into the nuts and bolts of the movie, we should sort of situate Dracula relative to other horror movies. Any thoughts on where Dracula itself or vampires in general sort of fit into the horror genre? And I realize we could do a, you know, whole episode just on this, so, you know, brief thoughts on this.
Oh, sure. I mean, one thing about vampires is that, like zombies and like some of these other critters, they are extraordinarily malleable movie monsters. So you can situate them in a number of different mythologies. You know, I've seen treatments of vampires where they are basically the result of, you know, some kind of bloodborne pathogen that makes people incapable of regenerating blood, so they have to take it in from other people. On the other extreme of it, you'd get something that is very Christianized, where, you know, the blood is the situation of life, according to either Leviticus or Deuteronomy. I should have looked that up. And so, you know, the vampire is the unholy taker of blood and sort of the inverse of Jesus, who gives his blood for salvation. And then you get, you know, stories that are more rooted in, you know, sort of more local Eastern European lore, where they really are these monsters of the night. You know, what their status is relative to our immortal souls or things like that. No one really knows and no one really cares, because they come out of graveyards and bite people and they're super creepy and they are associated with, you know, bats and wolves and other nocturnal animals. So, you know, one of the cool things about vampires as a narrative monster is that they will work so nicely in any kind of narrative, in a way that, for instance, Frankenstein, you pretty much have to situate that in a, you know, Industrial Revolution kind of era or later. There's no real way to make Frankenstein medieval. There's not a real easy way to situate the mummy before Napoleon Bonaparte, because before then you don't have Egyptology and you don't have people getting into tombs. Vampires, on the other hand, you could pretty much plunk down in pre-Christian times, Christian era, you know, 21st century, why not, you know, give them hot rods, they'll drive them around. You know, yeah. That they're just an eminently flexible movie monster. Well, what else is there to say about vampires as a class of critter, Dan?
Yeah, so I agree with what you said there. I think that they are pretty flexible. One thing that when you were speaking there that occurred to me is like how like they, you can situate them in any era. Like a lot of the modern vampire movies tend to, like you say, try to bend toward a more almost scientific bent, and that they have some kind of, you know, quasi scientific explanation for how vampires come to be. And like in the Blade movies, they even have a subspecies designation for vampire. I forget what it was, like Homo Nocturnus or something like that. And you know, various reasons for how one becomes a vampire, like you said, from some kind of pathogen similar to the zombie zombie genre and everything. I guess I don't really have much more to say about it than that, other than that I find that sort of change and from a sort of a very supernatural flavor from the 19th century adaptations to more of a modernistic, you know, scientific bent toward how around the whole subject. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, one sign of what kind of vampire story you are in, there we go, is how do vampires respond to crosses? And I mean, I'm sure people have written graduate papers on that and probably journal articles. But, you know, I mean, do your vampires immediately shrink from the sign of the cross? Does the personal faith of the person holding the cross matter? Are crosses completely irrelevant? You know, does anyone even mention crosses? You know, I mean, that really, in my mind, is one of the signs that will immediately tell you what kind of vampire story you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think, I think you guys are both right. I think that vampires are compelling, and obviously we could talk about, you know, human obsession with morbidity or sexuality that stretches across, you know, generations and all times and all places. But I think there's a little more to it than that, because obviously we have lots of ways we could personify sex and death without necessarily needing a vampire for it. But I think vampires sort of touch on something deeper in our consciences. They're a physical literary manifestation, if you can have such a thing, of the classical definition of evil. So they're literally anti-life, right? So if evil is the absence of good in sort of the Platonic or Augustinian reasoning, a parasite on things that exist, well, that's what vampires are, right? They're undead. They're the absence of everything, even the peace of death. I think we have the line in the movie where Dracula says that death is a glorious goal. I wrote this down. To die, to be truly dead, there are far worse things awaiting man than death. So they exist as a twisted parody of life and light and goodness. And like Nathan was saying, how you defeat them and sort of their own nature that gives you the perspective of the writers or the filmmakers or whatever on what goodness is and on what evil is. Where the vampire, I think, in a way that the Mummy and Frankenstein and the other movie monsters or even just traditional film and literary monsters can't be. The vampire sort of fills that role of evil embodied. I suppose there might be other critters out there that do that, but at least in the Dracula version of the vampire myth, that seems to be sort of where they fall.
Yeah, and just kind of springing off of that and what Nathan was saying is about you can situate your vampire movie based on how they respond to the cross. Another thing, there's also you can also situate your vampire movie based on whether or not the vampire is sort of presented as the epitome, as a type of evil, as, you know, embodiment of evil. So like, obviously in this movie and in some of the older ones, that's the case. They're wholly evil. They represent, you know, anti-life, you know, forces and things like that. But in the more modern movies, you get a lot muddier waters and a lot more gray areas there. Like, again, going back to the Blade movies, it's been a while since I've seen them, but there's a whole arching narrative there where the vampires are this subculture that is trying to just survive. And then there's even one of the movies where they're being hunted themselves by a super vampire or vampire killer or something like that. That they're trying to find ways to coexist with humans, and at least some factions of them are, and that you'll get vampires in modern movies that will try to resist the urge to drink the blood of living humans. So they'll get like blood packs from like hospitals and drink the blood from those instead, and so on. So you get this sort of change from this, okay, this vampire is just evil and it's just going to do evil things, to this vampire that's like, oh, this is a bad gig that I got, that I became a vampire, but you know, I can resist this, I can still be good, or other kind of interesting, you know, narratives going on there. So that's something that I think is kind of interesting.
And that's where, so yeah, I agree that obviously you have things like the Blade movies, True Blood, some of the episodes of Supernatural where you have the more morally ambiguous vampires, the Twilight series, right, where they're even held up as good. Yes, I think you're right. Although the fundamentalist in me wants to rise up and say that's just a sign of the depravity of our generation, right? Where they take this evil thing and say it's actually good.
Yeah, without making any sort of value judgment on that one way or the other, I just think that's a kind of an interesting change, and make of that what you will. But that's certainly one interpretation, that there's sort of like, oh, let's not call anything evil anymore, you know, kind of, you know, road that a lot of modernity has taken. So hard to disagree to some extent with what you're saying there.
And then one of the additions that Bela Lugosi's Dracula in particular makes to, you know, the screen vampire is that, you know, before this in the 1920s film Nosferatu, you know, the vampire is this horrendous, hideous, monstrous looking thing, whereas Bela Lugosi's version, and you guys will have to comment on whether this holds with the novel or if it's a departure from the novel, he is an eternally young, middle-aged, attractive man. I think it's fascinating that, you know, at the beginning of cinematic culture there, with this obsession with the youthful and the obsession with young looking people, vampires are, by definition, eternally young-looking, whereas everyone around them ages. And I think of, you know, the Anne Rice novel, Interview with the Vampire. I mean, one of the real terrors of that movie, existentially, not necessarily, you know, bump-in-the-night terrors, is that one of the vampires was vampirized as a child. And so, you know, you have this mental life that has hundreds of years of experience tacked onto it, and, you know, is this old cynical soul that's eternally trapped in this, I forget, 8-9-year-old girl's body.
Right.
So, I mean, that's another addition to that tradition. I mean, is that dynamic playing out in the Stoker novel?
Go ahead. You want to go with that first, Coyle?
Yeah. So it's been a while since I've read it, but from what I remember, yes and no. So when he is in Transylvania, he is in sort of an aged, distinguished aristocratic count, but older. And when he moves to England and starts, you know, dining on this young, energetic, new world, not really new world, but certainly newer than Romania, blood, then he begins to sort of move backwards in his age and ends up being kind of a early middle age, younger guy who is then attractive in the aristocrat and so on. That's how I remember it. Dan, am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I hadn't got too super far into it. I stopped right about the point where he had just made it across the sea to England, but there
Sorry, spoiler alert.
Oh, yeah. Spoilers. Anyway, during, Yes, but yeah, I noticed that in and there's even foreshadowing of that at the end of the series of letters that was written from Jonathan Harker that makes up the beginning of the book, where, yeah, he starts out, like you said, having this older appearance, and then towards the end there, right, and here, big spoiler alert here, right at the end of his last letter, he goes down and sees Dracula in his coffin, and notices that he had obviously just fed on some blood, because he's got blood dripping down and out of his mouth and stuff while he's lying there in the coffin, but that he looks a lot younger because of that. So there's this sort of idea that the vampire can stave off the effects of aging and even reverse it by imbibing blood. So,
Nathan, did you have any follow-up to that?
Not necessarily, except to say that, you know, this is the problem that, you know, the vampire television series ran into, is that, while vampires are eternally young, James Marsters and, other people who played vampires are not.
Right, right.
So, I mean,
right.
You can do a vampire movie a lot better than you can do, 10 seasons of a vampire series.
Yeah, and obviously the Universal movie doesn't explicitly draw the youth old age contrast, but they do. There are a couple of points where they do contrast Dracula with kind of the average English people that I thought were sort of interesting. So like when he attacks the girl who's selling, what was it, flowers, buttonhole flowers or something like that, and then they show him walking down the street, and it's one of the few semi-actiony shots in the movie, but he is kind of very slowly, casually strolling, dressed in his cape and top hat and all of that. I don't know if he's supposed to stand out because of his clothing or whatever. I mean, he's in England, he's dressing funny. That to me is what you do when you're in England. But he's moving very slowly, and the crowd around him is in a huge hurry, right? Everyone is rushing for wherever they're trying to go. So there's that contrast of sort of the slower pace compared to everyone else. Not maybe the same thing as the age contrast, but still drawing some kind of line of difference, right? He is from a different time, even if he doesn't necessarily look like it.
Yeah, and there's also that sense that he has a more singular purpose in the way he carries himself than the people around him.
Right. Nathan, anything to add in on that?
Not on that one, no. I'm ready to talk about the journey to England.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. So he enslaves Renfield, which is a major deviation from the book, where in the mm-hmm. book it is it's Jonathan Harker, right, who's in the castle as the solicitor, and manages to escape, and not to spoil the book. Gets on the ship the Vesta and sails to England. I don't know how many spoilers we want to give, but eating people all along the way, eating the crew on the way.
Yeah.
And then sort of the ship arrives as a I guess a ghost ship with I think that's probably the best scene in the movie, like the arrival of the ship in London.
Yeah.
Where everyone on it is dead. The captain is lashed to the wheel, which is right out of the book.
Yeah.
The captain is tied to the wheel, sort of in the cruciform position, dead, and only Renfield is alive, and he's clearly insane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who that actor was that played Renfield, but that shot of the policeman looking down the stairs at him, like, I thought that was sort of the one genuinely creepy part of the movie.
So did Jack Nicholson get that inspiration from that look for The Shining? Because, gosh, I was getting shades of that from that character in the movie, just the eyes and the like, here's Johnny, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't even think about that, but yeah, that makes sense. So that's the journey. Nathan, what did you want to say about that?
Well, first of all, yeah, I mean, that scene when the ship arrives, and I mean, you've got the crucified crew members, very clearly a hearkening back to that, Antichrist character of the vampire. You've also got, the fact that, I can't remember, because you said in the show notes that the ship's name changed in the movie. Was it the Demeter?
It's the Vesta in the movie and the Demeter in the book.
Okay, well, shoot, because I was going to comment about Demeter. because, I mean, if you've got that Demeter image, this is the mother who loses her daughter to the god of death. And, you know, so right out of the gate there, I mean, that literary allusion, you've got this creature who very literally climbs out of the grave to wreak havoc on the earth the way that Pluto does in Ovid's Metamorphoses, or that version of the story at any rate. So, you know, that I really like that. Vesta, honestly, I'm not as familiar with, you know, the narratives that Vesta's, you know, concerned with. I know that she's the goddess of hearth and home, but I mean, beyond that, you know, she doesn't have any daughters kidnapped that I'm aware of, so I don't know where to go from there.
I should have looked this up before the show. Vesta isn't just the Roman name for Demeter, is it?
Oh, no. Demeter is a Ceres in the
Ovid.
That's
right.
Yeah, in the Ovid version of the tale, it's Ceres, the goddess of the harvest.
Yeah, then I don't know why
Vesta. Yeah, I don't know either.
Clearly, there's a deep theological reason here that we're just not getting.
Well, of course, when I hear the word names Ceres, Vesta, Demeter, I just think of the asteroids and the asteroid belt.
Right.
So, yeah.
So that's my scientific brain there.
Right.
Well, anything else on the arrival of the ship?
Danny, I mean, what you already talked about, you know, the look that Renfield throws up the stairs.
Right.
You know, I mean, I guess the other thing, and I mean, I just don't know enough about the English postal system in the 19th century, but, you know, the fact that the boxes of Transylvania dirt aren't, you know, in a, I don't know, an evidence room somewhere in some police station, rather than being shipped off where they're supposed to be, always puzzled me. But I
TSA snacked them at the border and is having to analyze them.
But somehow they end up at Carfax Abbey. And of course I had forgotten that was the name of the abbey. That's a lot funnier now that there's the you know, information on buying used automobiles website.
I hadn't thought about that either.
I did want to make one comment that's like neither here nor there, but it's just something that for whatever reason stuck with me and it gives you more insight into how my brain works. But that during the storm scene with the boat, with the ship coming in, that I don't know what they were using to make the sounds of the storm, but it was pretty lame. And it seems like they should have used the rotating burlap drum that was used for the tornado scene in Wizard of Oz, because that one was way more convincing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe it was something with the particular audio track of the film that I saw, but it was just sort of like this high pitched like kind of noise, and it was just like, what? Sound like a storm at all? Anyway, like I said, that's neither here nor there. But
and that's actually probably a good point to mention the sound in the movie. Right there is a ton of silence, and numerous scenes of people sort of staring intensely at each other.
Well, there's the silence, but at least with the version I saw, this annoying hissing, you know, that was pretty loud at times during the silence. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
I think that's probably just the older style recording.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you this, guys, because I've never seen the version with the score added on.
Yeah, I was going to say there is a later version that Universal hired Philip Glass to record a score for it. And then they added on. Mm-hmm. I've only
seen the version that just has the what's the name of the piece at the beginning? Swan Lake, and then no music after that. I've never seen the one with Philip Glass. So, And apparently you guys haven't either. So sorry,
No. It's okay. I have. It's been a while. I don't remember it necessarily adding anything to the movie because it's fairly subdued. But again, it's been a while, so I may not be remembering that correctly.
Okay, fair enough.
So we're told in the movie why Dracula is going to England.
Oh gosh, I must have missed that if they did say anything. I didn't get that. I don't remember hearing that anywhere in the movie. Do you remember, Nathan?
No, and like I said, I, you know, when I first saw it, I hadn't read the book, but I had seen the 1992 you know, Gary Oldman and Keanu Reeves Dracula, where they did go into that backstory. So I think I just kind of assumed it, but from the future rather than from the past, like you guys did, that, you know, he's going there specifically to find Mina.
Right. And I think, I don't think they do tell us, or if they did, all three of us missed it. But I think the implication seems to be, and this is at least similar to the book, you know, he is the horseman who picks up Renfield. And then he is the guy who, you know, lays out Renfield's food and brings in his bags. Like, he's the only person in that castle other than the vampire women.
Right.
Who I think they make an appearance in the movie. I don't remember now.
Yeah, the three brides of Dracula.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they do in like at least one scene. Yeah, there's not
but
much.
But they are completely unexplained in the
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, it's just they just show up. He's like, who? What?
Yeah. And then they disappear, and we never see them again. I think the implication, at least, is that he's eaten everyone there is to eat. The villagers know sort of to stay out of his way and how to put up the crosses or whatever to keep him out. I think the implication is there's no more food there, and England is this feast.
Yeah,
where no one believes in him anyway. There's that line at one point about how his greatest defense is that nobody believes in him.
Yeah,
so,
I noted that, and it's shades of like what I don't know where this quote comes from, but people talk about like the greatest trick that Satan ever played on the world was convincing them that he doesn't exist or something like that. It's like,
I feel like it's from Screwtape Letters.
Yeah. That sounds right. But that's interesting kind of a parallel to that there anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also an interesting parallel to, and obviously, I mean, this movie comes out before Bulgakov writes, what is the name of the novel? Master and Margarita.
Master and Margarita.
Where, Satan comes to, is it St. Petersburg?
Or Moscow, I forget which.
Yeah, one of the two, and, you know, just flies into a rage because he can't terrify anyone because everyone's an atheist and they don't believe in the devil.
Right. That's we should do a crossover episode on that someday. Obscure Russian novel crossover for the Christian Humanist Podcast. I will say I do genuinely love that book, though. It's a great one.
It's been a while since I've read it, but I enjoyed it.
Anything else on sort of Dracula in Transylvania moving to England?
Well, one thing about it is that he seeks out, you know, Carfax Abbey, which is, you know, an abandoned monastery. So in some ways, he seeks out the most Transylvania-like place that he can find in England, which is no small feat given that so much of it is modernized. And it's telling that even though it is a place of Christian worship at its roots historically, that doesn't matter nearly as much as the fact that it is old, whereas everything else in England is new.
Hmm. Right. And there's obviously no idea that he's going to update. I guess he's not going to try to conform to the modern world. Instead, that he's trying to bring the world back to them.
Yeah, and even says that explicitly in there. He says like there when he's in that scene talking about to Seward and stuff when he first meets him at the play. He's like, they ask him, they say, oh yeah, well you'll have to do a lot of renovations. He's like, I'm not going to renovate anything. Or something to that effect. Like, he's very proud of that.
Yeah. So again, there's that idea, and that sort of moves us toward the big theme that maybe we should hold off on for a minute anyway. So we meet Dracula, and then we meet the what in the book is sort of an all-star team of rivals, and what in the movie is kind of a bunch of boobs and Van Helsing. The book has all of these great sort of heroic, Wild West cowboy. Well, one of them actually is a Wild West cowboy in the book.
Yeah.
In the movie, you've got Van Helsing and then Seward and Harker, who are both, I mean, kind of underwhelming figures in general. But Van Helsing, we meet him surrounded by test tubes, hearing someone read from an old book in Latin. So we know he's really smart, right? what are we supposed to think about the people who are opposed to Dracula? So Van Helsing, Seward, Harker, and then I suppose Lucy and Mina to a lesser extent.
Well, one thing that I immediately notice about Van Helsing is that he is a mixture of the new science and the old lore. And I wonder if that, you know, the Dutch name has any kind of, you know, particular cultural resonance. There we go. In, you know, a late 19th century novel that I miss now. I know that, for instance, you know, in the 17th and 18th centuries, the Enlightenment, you know, has one of its centers there in Amsterdam. And, you know, of course, You've got the history of, you know, the scholarship of Erasmus and so on and so forth. So it's a site of learning in that time. I don't know if it persists there in the 19th century, but Van Helsing himself in this movie, you know, is, like Coyle said, I mean, the only competent person in this whole crew. He stands as a force of opposition to Dracula. And mm-hmm. part of what makes him capable of resisting Dracula is that he can actually look at Dracula and see that this is a different kind of being. So, you know, whereas the rest of them know that there are weird things happening, because they can't even entertain the possibility of a vampire, Van Helsing has that edge over them epistemologically.
Yeah.
He can deal with Dracula because he believes in Dracula.
Yeah, the knowledge is power. Well, what else is going on? Yeah.
Yeah, keep rolling, Danny.
Yeah, I totally caught that too. It's just like he just stands out as like a really competent, like, yeah, I've got this, you know, he can't harm me kind of attitude. And there's that one scene there where in lots of other places in the movie, you see Dracula just staring down people, and like in some cases putting them under his thrall seemingly just by looking at them, or commanding them just by looking at them, or causing them to pass out or faint just by looking at them. But when he looks at Van Helsing, there's this really, I thought was a really cool scene where he's just, at first he's just like, you're not going to, he's telling him to come here, you know, come here. And he just, nope, I'm not going to, you don't have any power. And then there's this one scene where it looks like he's about to falter, and then suddenly he pulls out the crucifix. And so I thought that was really a really interesting scene, that where he's like, yes, he has this knowledge. He knows what Dracula is about. You know, he knows his game. And through that and the symbol of faith, he's able to resist him. But he needs that additional symbol of faith. It's not just his knowledge of the situation that is protecting him in that case. I think that scene sort of showed that pretty well. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and they sort of reference, right, he and Seward are talking at one point, and they sort of reference that, where Van Helsing says, you know, this is a vampire, and Seward says, you know, hang on, I've got the quote, but Professor Van Helsing, modern medical science does not admit of such a thing, which probably worth remembering that Seward himself is also a doctor, right? He runs the sanitarium, Van Helsing's reply is, I may be able to bring proof that the superstition of yesterday may become the scientific fact of today. So yeah, there's that idea that the science has to be supplemented by the, well, superstition, I guess, if we want to use the word, but they're not necessarily separate things, and they have to be kept together.
Hmm.
You can't divide them from each other if you're going to resist someone like Dracula.
Right. Hmm. And it's an interesting connection there to Frankenstein, which Book of Nature is doing Frankenstein, aren't they?
I believe so, yes.
Well, and, you know, I'm thinking mainly of the Mary Shelley novel, not necessarily the Boris Karloff film. But, you know, Victor Frankenstein is fascinated with creating life, but in order to do so, he has to abandon the very modern science of the medical school there at Geneva, and instead turn towards, you know, these medieval, you know, alchemical manuals,
yeah,
and magic books in order to bring the creature to life. So I think it's an interesting parallel here. And I mean, it's definitely got its roots there in that English Romantic moment where, you know, you've kind of reached a point where, you know, enlightenment fascination with science has not waned at all. But there's definitely a sense that, you know, the things that Enlightenment flavor science dismisses immediately might actually have some kind of reality beyond the bounds of what science can talk about.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it.
Well, and I think it's it's interesting. So when I teach on conservatism, if I have time in the semester, I try to assign this book as kind of a counterpoint, where I think if you look at Dracula as representing all of the bad sides of tradition and kind of the way the things used to be and old world whatevers that we're kicking off in the modern world, the alternative to that the book holds up, or that the movie in this case holds up, is this guy who combines faith and reason together. Right. He is a scientist, but he also uses the crucifix, and he knows all of the ancient lore. In the book, sorry again, Danny. Spoiler alert. In the book, he actually uses communion wafers, Roman Catholic communion wafers, which I would be interested to know what Catholics think about this particular use of their transubstantiated host to quote unquote desecrate Dracula's boxes of earth. So by placing them in the boxes, it neutralizes the evil of the earth. Again, that combined with all of the science that they use to save Dracula's victims who are drained of blood by giving them blood back.
The transfusions. Yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Which I don't. Maybe I'm mixing up book and movie again. Do we actually see a transfusion in the movie?
They talk about one.
Okay.
There's a scene where they're talking about.
Yeah, they make reference of the process of turning someone into a vampire as, you know, taking blood from the vampire.
Right.
Actually turns you into a vampire instead of simply killing you, which is what happens if the vampire just drinks rather than giving as well.
Right, but I think, isn't there one part where they actually mention the word transfusion and like they had, maybe I misinterpreted it, but they had tried to do a transfusion for somebody and it didn't work because they had lost too much blood?
Yeah, for Lucy, right? They show her corpse
on the
table.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Which that is in the book, although the edition of I Have has a footnote that points out that, yes, they knew about transfusions when Stoker wrote the book, but they didn't yet know about blood typing. So, you know, transfusions were not necessarily the safest thing in the world, and you certainly couldn't have, you know, five or six people all giving blood to, you know, Lucy and Mina without doing as much damage as Dracula was doing.
Sure. Interesting.
Anyway, that's sort of an aside. But again, I think the bigger point of the heroes are these champions of faith and reason standing against old world traditions, right? It's a very sort of good guy, bad guy, white hat, black hat, progressive, conservative in kind of those parallels. Which I think is just a fascinating read, and then an interesting watch on the big screen too.
Right, and then, you know, one interesting thing I'm jumping ahead, but this came to mind, so I'm going to do it. One interesting thing about the recent Netflix Castlevania series is that they take those elements and they just kind of jumble them all up so that Dracula, as an immortal being, has, at least they're implying, and I've only watched the first season, they haven't released the second one yet, but they imply in the show that he has basically gleaned technology from, you know, all of these different civilizations, so that in the 15th century he has already constructed, you know, heliocentric models of the solar system and things like that, so that, you know, I mean, basically, it's a Richard Dawkins fantasy that, you know, this Antichrist figure has compiled all of the science of the human species, and it's the evil church that's trying to keep people from getting to it.
Wow.
But again, that's just the supreme flexibility of the mythology, right? Because here we are in 2017, and we've got a vampire who is the man of science and who takes a stand against a corrupt church and is, you know, sort of this blood drinking Galileo figure.
Wow. That's, oh boy, I might have to look into that just to see how they do that, pull that off.
Don't watch it with the kids because that show has a potty mouth that doesn't stop.
Oh, no worries about that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, it sounds good, but yeah, we won't expose the kids to it.
Yeah.
anything else on the heroes here?
I do have one question about what you guys thought about. So, you know, part of my analytic part of me here is just trying to find holes in the plot here and there. And I know that I can't do that too much without spoiling it. But there was one thing that kind of bugged me a little bit about Van Helsing was, so he's got this crucifix, right? And he's able to resist Dracula with that. But then he's got this, and he's got all this wolfsbane that he has put in Mina's room so that she can't get out, so that Dracula can't get in and influence her or whatever. But my part of me was asking, well, why doesn't he just give her a crucifix, you know, and have her wear that around her neck? Because Wolfsbane just was, you couldn't take it away. There was something about how I got the impression it wasn't as effective. And so I was just wondering what you guys thought about that. Am I just really off the rails here, or am I just seeing something that's not
there? No, they're clearly not very invested in protecting Mina, right? I mean, they put her in a room full of Wolfsbane, leave the nurse with like instructions not to take the Wolfsbane under any circumstances. And basically the first time she's asked to do so,
right,
she does. Like, I mean,
yeah,
clearly they just aren't that interested in it, or they're so, I don't know, maybe they have some other job that's keeping them busy. I don't understand, because every time you turn around, Mina's back with Dracula.
Right. It's the same thing with Renfield. He's always getting out and getting around everywhere, and I guess the guard for the sanitarium, just all he does is insult him the whole time, and it can't seem to keep him, locked up or whatever. But Renfield just seems to always be getting out, and
it's almost a throwaway line, but I think the last time we see Martin, the guard, taking Renfield off, Martin mumbles something that I don't think I would have caught without the subtitles on, but it's something to the effect of, Renfield, I hate to have to lock you up, but I'm just going to have to, which, you know, not the best attitude of a sanitarium guard. so maybe the implication is he keeps letting him out because he feels bad for him. I don't know.
But it just seems kind of amusing that he's supposed to be watching him and taking care of him, and just he doesn't seem to have any competence in that at all.
Right. And Dan, I might be overreading the crucifix bit in this movie, but I mean, I think the encounter with the crucifix only happens twice, yes? Once with Renfield at the beginning and once with Van Helsing at the end.
Right.
I think that's right.
Well, it strikes me that in both of those moments, and I might be reading some Protestant theology too hard into this, but in both of those moments, the terror of the person holding the crucifix almost implies a sort of spiritual reaching out to Christ, and that's what does it. Whereas the wolfsbane is, you know, inherently an inert, organic thing. I mean, it's not invested in a symbol system the way that the crucifix, or not crucifix, it's a crucifix in the 1992 version, in the same way that the cross is, so that, you know, it's implied, even if it's not directly stated, that wolfsbane is just kind of inherently odious to vampires, whereas, the cross seems to be interacting with a human subject when it has that power to terrify. Now, like I said, with all the plot holes you guys are pointing out, I think I might be thinking about this more than Universal Studios was, but what do you think about that, Dan?
I think I had this very similar thoughts when I was thinking about it. It's like, okay, because that was a question I asked. It's like, okay, why doesn't he give Mina one? And then I thought, okay, maybe it has to be something that it interacts, you know, with that person's, you know, faith to a degree that, you know, it does. It's not just like, oh, we'll just sprinkle Wolfsbane everywhere. So I think I agree with you. I think that there might at least. I don't know if Universal was had this in mind, but it seems like at least a plausible way of reading this. I think what got me thinking, asking that question to begin with, though, just to come back to that real quick, was that when in that scene that I was talking about with Dracula and Van Helsing, Dracula is just sort of like asking him, "Oh, what? You have some Wolfsbane?" Kind of like in a mocking voice, like implying that it wasn't really that effective,
right?
And so then I was thinking, okay, if it's not, why don't we give the cross to her? But what you say there, Nathan, makes a lot of sense to me, at least.
In the book, by the time they're actively trying to protect Mina, she is too corrupted by Dracula to be able to bear the cross. Like I think at one point they give it to her and it burns her so badly it scars her. So again, it may be just that they're assuming we already know the story because people were familiar with Dracula. But you're right, it's this gaping plot hole that either that or they're just not that invested in protecting her. I don't know that there's another excuse.
Well, and actually, this occurs to me, Dan, when I heard you talking about, you know, the mocking, "Oh, do you have some wolfsbane?"
Something like that. Yeah,
I wonder if this is the movie that starts the trope of people being misinformed about what really stops vampires. Because, I mean, that is a trope
that
every vampire movie after Dracula works to some effect, right? You know, if you hold up the cross but you are a hypocrite, then it doesn't have any power. Or you pour holy water on the vampire and the vampire says, oh, I'm going to have to dry clean this. Or, you know, you eat garlic and, you know, the vampire says, you know, well, I hope your dinner tasted good. You know, so, I mean, I that just occurred to me that, I mean, every vampire story I can think of after Dracula plays on that misinformation plot structure, right? The people go in thinking, I have the thing that will be able to defeat the vampire, but it turns out not to be true.
Yeah, it's sort of like a prefiguring of that, at least to some degree. Sure.
What? Anything else on these hero figures? Otherwise, we should move on to the victims so we get through all of our characters.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'll just say that because I'm more familiar with the 1992, which I keep referring to, and I have no idea why I watched it so much as a teenager. I think it says something about me that I don't necessarily want to explore right now. but that version does have the cowboy character, and it does have the Posse Comitatus that goes after Dracula at the end. So
right.
I'm getting a sense hearing you guys talk about the book that for all of its faults, Coppola's version of it does reincorporate a lot of the novel that the Bela Lugosi just kind of cuts out to, you know, keep it down to an hour and 20 minutes.
Right. And it still feels like 7 hours instead of an hour and 20 minutes, but it's my modern movie prejudice.
Yeah, and I haven't seen the 92 one, so at least not that I remember, so I can't comment there. But
I mean, it is such a deeply flawed movie, but it's also a lot of fun. You know, if nothing else, Anthony Hopkins as Von Helsing is just a delight. So, you know, I mean, I don't even have to say anymore. You can already imagine his voice reciting those lines.
Sure, yeah.
Well, we should talk a little bit about the victims. So by my count, there were three that we get a lot of focus on, Lucy and Mina and Renfield. What are we supposed to make of these three individuals and how where do they fit into the overall theme of the movie?
Well, Dan, I'll start with Lucy and then I'll hand off to you and you can pick one of the other two. Just because Lucy's easy. I mean, you know. she is the evidence in the film that that vampires can kill people, that can kill characters with names. So, I mean, she doesn't appear very long, but unlike all of the sailors on the boat, she is mourned after she dies. So strictly on a plot level, she introduces an urgency to this story. It's not just a faceless victim or, you know, faceless carnage, I'll put it that way. But you have a genuine victim. So Lucy, as the Bela Lugosi film presents her, is a friend of the Harkers, and you know she is a victim of Dracula. You really don't know much about it because she is largely there to set up the danger to Mina. So I mean, you assume as you continue watching the movie that the same things that happened to Mina before happened to Lucy, but those things largely get left implied. So, Dan, what about Mina?
Okay, so Mina is one of these sort of like if like you said, Lucy's the reminder that vampires can kill people. Mina and Renfield are reminders that the vampires can variously corrupt or control or take over people's wills. And in the case of Mina, you get this sort of like alternating between where she seems just fine and herself to getting this vacant stare where she's talking to the bat even the bat's not saying anything. She's hearing Dracula's voice in her mind saying, yes, I will obey. Then there's a scene where she's talking to Jonathan, who's her fiance in both the book and the movie, right? I think basically saying, I can't be with you anymore. I'm sorry. I've been, you know, the implication is that she's been basically taken by Dracula and Dracula has a hold on her. And so she cannot, you know, be with him. And then the next scene, she's seems normal again. So there's this sort of like shades of this, you know, mental instability. You know, I mean, this is all taking place near a sanitarium, or in a sanitarium, maybe, at least the building near there. And this sort of this idea that this mental illness instability is being instigated by Dracula's presence. And so that's how it occurs for Mina, but for Renfield, this is much more obvious, like he's pretty much all the time on crazy mode, where he's got this wild look in his eyes all the time. There's a few scenes where he seems normal and he starts talking about how he, you know, wishes that he could be helped and whatever. But in plenty of the other times, he's just going around just talking about how, you know, basically the crazy talk about how he wants to follow his master's will and things like that. And I'm rambling a bit, so I'm going to stop there. But I don't know. What do I have the right of it here? Am I on the right track, or any other thoughts on that?
I've always wondered whether J.R.R. Tolkien was familiar with Dracula, because Renfield's madness finds such echoes in Gollum. You know, he's always talking to his invisible master.
Sure.
He has these murderous rages that are triggered by the present or absent master. You know, he's got all of these signs that, you know, so often we associate with, you know, the worst kind of drug addiction. You know, the loss of the mind and the violent impulses and, you know, things like that. So that, you know, he's a terrifying figure in a different way from the way that Dracula is. Dracula is consummately in control and manipulating the situation and changing people's minds, whereas Renfield has lost any kind of stability that would give him a mind to change in the first place. And I'll go ahead and note that, you know, since you guys aren't as familiar with the 92 version as I am, that William Renfield is played by Tom Waits.
Okay.
Which, I mean, if you can just imagine, you know, that voice with that character speaking to his invisible master, I mean, it is just as glorious as you think it might be.
Although I will trump your Tom Waits with a Peter McNichol from the Dracula Dead and Loving It movie.
Okay, that does beat it. That does beat it.
Just barely, though. I'd forgotten Tom Waits played that.
But what you said there, I mean, I hadn't even thought of that parallel with Gollum, but yeah, now that you say it, that's dead on. I mean, it's very similar, you know, the way he carries himself and, like you said, talking to the master. I mean, it's just, yeah, there's something there, I think. I was going to say something else, but I forgot it, so maybe come back to me. And I'll think.
Well, and then he's also like this sort of very diminished parody of Dracula in that, you know, he derives all of his sustenance from the blood of the living, but it's the living rats and the living roaches and the living crawling things of the earth. I mean, there's not even the dignity, insofar as you can call it dignity, of destroying people body and soul in order to get your sustenance. I mean, this is literally a bottom feeder that Dracula has made such. So, I mean, he is, in some ways, you know, one of the most horrifying victims of Dracula, because he has taken away his human soul in a way that, you know, when he just drops bodies, you really don't see that play out.
One thing I remember I was going to say about that, and something that you said made me remember this about Renfield, was you're talking about how he's, you know, he doesn't have a mind to be won over or something along those lines because he's gone crazy. And there's that scene in there where he makes that comment that God will not damn a lunatic. He won't damn a lunatic soul.
Right, right.
So there's in the moments of clarity that he has, like there's that moment, and then there's that other moment where he walks in on Van Helsing and Seward and the others discussing various things about Dracula's nature, and he says, "And I'm the he says something along the lines of, "Oh, I'm walking in on a conversation that sounds crazier than I am," or something like that. Like there's a little rare moment of humor there where like they're talking crazy, but he's the one who's actually nuts, and he recognizes it and realizes it. And I just thought that was kind of an amusing little bit there. I probably butchered the quote there, but I think you got my point. But I think that was a real, I thought that was actually a touching scene there where he's saying, yeah, he knows that he is messed up. He knows that he has been, you know, taken over by Dracula, but he's resting his hope in that God will still save him, because in some way it's not his fault that he's like the way
that he is. That scene does take place in their private quarters. So once again, he is, you know, out of his cell and roaming about the mansion. But there's the parallel to that at at the very end of the movie, right before Dracula kills him. He basically says, you can't kill me yet. I still have all of these lives on my conscience.
Right. Yeah. That was chilling.
Yeah. Well, and again, there's that idea of, sticking with the Roman Catholicism, right? I need to go to confession, before I'm, yeah, and receive the last rites and so on before I'm ready for this. And, even mm-hmm. that gets denied to him. Right. So, he's just this cautionary tale for the weak willed out there, for the, Mina and Lucy, to some extent, the corruption of evil is forces outside of their control. Renfield seems to sort of fling himself into it. Again, the movie sort of glosses over and assumes that we can fill in the step between him being just the normal British solicitor who gets a paper cut in the castle and the raving lunatic on the ship. But I think the implication is he's okay with this change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and another thing, though, is that they conflate the characters of Jonathan Harker and Renfield in the whole scene where he's at the castle. That was supposed to be Jonathan Harker in the book, spoiler alert, but they make it just the character Renfield, and there is a Jonathan Harker in the movie, but he's never goes to the castle like he does in the
yeah book. I mean, they have to invent, I mean, or really they don't even invent, I mean, there's just no explanation for why he's there, you know. It's like, well, we gotta have a Jonathan Harker here, so he's at a party with his uncle.
Well, and he does absolutely nothing. So like in the final scene when, you know, they capture Dracula and Van Helsing kills him, like Harker is what, like hiding in a corner? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, the only thing he seems to be there in the movie for is to sort of bring out the level of corruption in Mina, right, by the conversations he has with her. He's sort of like the foil to her in that sense.
Well, gents, with the goal of keeping this at a Christian humanist podcast length rather than a City of Man podcast length, we should move towards the end. So I think Nathan, you're an English major, so correct me on this. I think sort of the overall theme of the movie is one of good versus evil. That seems to be the point of it. What does Dracula have to say about that I suppose we haven't already said in the conversation?
Well, one thing about this movie that, again, I didn't remember from when I saw it 20 years ago, is that you really don't have any visible signs of the actual taking of blood. Unlike later vampire stories, no one has two pointed wounds on their necks. Dracula's teeth never show. Instead, what you get are just repeated lengthy shots of his eyes with, you know, just the eyes lit while the rest of his face is in shadow. And I think the picture of evil that this film presents is one that is really drawing out from the souls of the victims the things that they would hide. And I say that because the locking of gazes that happens so often in this film, I mean, usually comes after somebody cautions somebody else against Dracula. But then once he comes in and he looks into their eyes and looks into their souls, they either fall victim to, you know, Dracula himself, or in the case of, you know, someone like Renfield, he falls into this madness that also has a bloodthirst to it. And either way you go, Dracula's evil is something that, you know, emerges from the dark part of the old world, but it's always something that relies on that eye-to-eye gaze. So, I mean, it is something very human. And honestly, I think that's what, you know, makes this a terrifying movie, even, you know, 90, give or take, years later. Dan, I mean, what else do you see going on here with the nature of evil in this movie?
Yeah, I think the whole fixation of the of the movie on eyes, particularly the several scenes where they just show, you know, a shot of Bela Lugosi's face with his face mostly in shadow, except for his eyes lit up from just fortuitously placed shafts of light. You know, that the idea is that these eyes can like drill into your soul, is sort of like the whole playing off the whole eyes as windows to the soul, and that he can weigh your sins and weigh your heart, but and his control over you to some extent has to do with whether or not how you accept his gaze, so to speak, and what your what is inside of you that he can see. I think what you're saying is right. It's just there's whether or not the characters, the various characters in the movie are able to resist him or not, seems to have a lot to do with how they look at him, how they react to his look. And like what we already talked about, Van Helsing having that combination of reason and faith, and how strong their will is. So I don't know if that really gets to good versus evil as much as like, I don't know. I mean, one of the things that occurred to me is like when it comes to the Christian tradition, we know about, you know, Paul saying things like when I am weak, then I am strong. And I don't really see a lot of that here. I see what I see is like a power of, I see battles of wills. Who can bring their righteousness to bear to keep Dracula away, and whether and if Dracula just has the will and the evil, then he can just take over somebody who's weaker will. I don't see this idea of surrendering to, you know, God or whatever, even if when it comes to, you know, how the movie is put with the, when the movie doesn't really per, really have a vehicle for that, but I don't really see much of that.
There's maybe a hint of that in that, particularly if we compare this to, you know, later vampire movies, and later, you know, more action-y movies, the conflict with Dracula isn't one of, you know, punching each other in the face. It is still a, sure, a conflict of, you know, faith, reason on the one side, Dracula's will to evil on the other side. That's not,
yeah.
I mean, they don't, you know, take baseball bats and try to knock him out of the sky as a bat. Right.
Well, that one guy tries to shoot him, right? But Martin tries to shoot the bat in Van Helsing, just like,
and they tell him like, to stop.
Yeah,
I don't,
they say
like,
that ain't going to work. Nice try.
No, Martin, keep shooting, Martin. Why, if it's not going to work, it doesn't hurt anything.
Yeah, I didn't remember that part. Yeah.
No, they didn't, but they, I mean,
oh,
they should,
oh,
have.
Okay.
They basically tell him to stop shooting, and I'm like, why would you, like,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. That's me as a modern American sort of, you know, reading myself back into it.
But yeah, I don't know. I just feel like there was, I got this sort of bad taste in my mouth about how if Dracula just has a strong enough will, then he can take somebody over who has a weaker will, and it's all about their power. Except, like you said, for the scene with, like I said, the scene with Van Helsing, I think is an interesting, you know, hint of there's more to it than just that. But just whenever Dracula is overpowering somebody else's will, it just seems to be just a raw battle of the real. It's not like you said, fisticuffs, you know, but it's this mental fisticuffs, I guess. So almost that's am I off base there, or am I?
No, and I think it would probably be reading too much into it to read this as a criticism of the modern world. I guess we have the line about, you know, no one his the strength of the vampires, you know, no one believes in him. So the idea being nobody in England can resist Dracula because nobody believes in anything anymore. But that's probably reading too much into it.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think that's reaching too much at all. I mean, that is why they need someone named Van Helsing to come in and save the day, because nobody named Renfield is going to be able to resist him, and nobody named Harker will even acknowledge that, you know, there's any such thing. Or Seward, not Harker, sorry. I got my characters mixed up there.
And even though they're all on that scene with the mirror, where everybody just keeps looking back and forth in the mirror and saying, huh, he's not in the mirror. And everybody there sees that, but there's Seward still like, you know, the skeptic there. And
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
kind of like, you just saw the evidence right there.
Right.
You know, or didn't see the evidence, so to speak. Yeah.
Everyone else assumes the mirror is broken.
Yeah. So anyway,
Anything else on the good evil stuff? Otherwise, we should hit our last question about later Dracula movies.
Oh, it's not specifically about good and evil, but I mean, one thing that I'd forgotten between the first time I saw this, you know, back in college and now, is just how funny Martin is. He was what kept me hanging in on this movie because, you know, his sort of little, you know, cockney comment, I mean, really does just kind of, you know, add levity to this movie that, you know, as you mentioned before, Coyle, is such a plodding movie. that mirror scene that Coyle just described in 12 seconds, I feel like it lasts about 20.
It is pretty long. Yeah. It's like, okay, we get the point. He doesn't have a reflection. Yeah.
But then every once in a while, Martin, you know, pops up and says, you know, and I can't even remember any of his particular lines. I just remember as slow as this movie was moving, his little one-liners just really did add laughter to it when I really needed it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he's like the archetype of like the inept mall cop or something like that, or inept security guard. He's just so comically inept that it's like, you got to think that inspired future versions of him.
Well, speaking of future versions, we should end with this, other Dracula movies that you've seen that people should watch, recommendations, things to avoid. What do you guys got?
I don't have a whole lot here. I mean, I've mentioned in the earlier the Blade movies. They're interesting in their own right for having a very different take on vampires than this movie and this book. So you might want to give them a shot if you haven't. I also vaguely remember seeing the movie Van Helsing. It's that, I think it was from 2004-ish, something like that. And it's not a very good movie, but what I found amusing about that movie is that it's just basically, it takes Dracula and Frankenstein and basically mashes them together. And like the whole movie's plot is about Dracula and Frankenstein are in cahoots, you know, to try to, I don't even remember the whole plot line, but they work together. And so it's sort of this anachronistic kind of combination of the Wolfman and the Frankenstein's monster and Dracula all together in one movie. And I mean, there's a lot of movies like that where it's just like monster movies. Let's just put all these monsters in there. But this one actually tries to make a coherent plot out of it. I don't think it succeeds very well, but it's kind of a fun romping movie. So you might want to, if you're not going to take it too seriously, it might be worth a look. That's all I really have.
I would add to that the 92 Bram Stoker's Dracula that I've been referring to throughout the episode. It is a deeply flawed movie. Some of the casting choices, you know, Keanu Reeves as Harker, Winona Ryder as Mina, I mean, they just fall flat. But then on the other hand, you have Gary Oldman, who, I mean, really is a passable Count Dracula. And then you got, like I said, Tom Waits as Renfield is just a delight. Anthony Hopkins as Van Helsing. I can't imagine anyone as Van Helsing who doesn't seem derivative of Anthony Hopkins.
That alone seems like it would be worth the price of admission. I love Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, man. So. Well, I will say that the Brides of Dracula scene is quasi-pornographic, which might have been why I watched it so much as a teenager. I can't remember what that. I read a newspaper review because there were newspapers back in 1992. They called it the most unsexy erotic scene they had ever seen on screen, and I don't disagree. But like I said, you know, you do have that dramatic, you know, race against the sunset at the end where you do have the cowboy character and Van Helsing's posse. So there's a lot going for it. There's a lot going against it. You know, go in with realistic expectations and don't bring the kids. And it might be an enjoyable couple hours. The other one that I mentioned earlier, I don't recommend, but I will talk about it just because of the cultural interest of it, is the Netflix Castlevania anime series that, you know, just recently dropped. Like I said, it turns Dracula into this proto-Galileo. he actually marries a human woman from this completely anachronistic free-thinking society in the 15th century, and it's because she is burned at the stake by the corrupt church that he vows revenge. He was actually kind of a nice guy before then. So, you know, if you're familiar with the Castlevania games, this has almost nothing to do with them other than it has Trevor Belmont and Dracula. But it is a fascinating artifact of just how flexible is the vampire character. And the answer, if you judge by this, almost infinitely. Coyle, what do you got?
You mentioned Nosferatu earlier. It's a silent film, and I, again, with my modern sensibilities, tend to find those almost unwatchable. But it is, you know, probably something that should be watched. It's certainly a landmark in the history of film. Related to that, there's a movie from the early 2000s called The Shadow of the Vampire. That's a sort of fan fiction about Nosferatu. The hook behind the movie is that the actor that they hired to play the vampire in Nosferatu was himself actually a vampire. So they get, I think it's Willem Dafoe, to play this vampire actor character, who, again, it's kind of an interesting movie. Dracula, the Universal movie Dracula that we've been talking about, spawns I don't even know how many sequels. And I want to say Bela Lugosi is in almost all of them, because, again, he ends up being sort of stereo cast. So Dracula's daughter and son of Dracula, House of Dracula, and then there's a
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Plan 9 from Outer Space, right, the last of them. There are a number of crossovers with Frankenstein that Universal makes, including one that my wife said I should recommend, although I don't think I've seen it, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which does include both Dracula and the Wolfman in it. Actually, my go-to Dracula movies are the Hammer series. So it starts with a movie called Horror of Dracula, with Christopher Lee as Dracula, and then Peter Cushing as Van Helsing. And then there's a whole series of sequels that come out of that. If it's even possible, they are more distant from the book than the Universal movies, but they're still fairly interesting. I've mentioned the Dracula Dead and Loving It, the Mel Brooks movie that I enjoyed and then didn't enjoy, and now I think I might enjoy it again, having watched Bela Lugosi. Dracula 2000, I would imagine a lot of people have seen that just because it was pretty popular when it came out back in 2000 with Gerard Butler as Dracula.
That sounds right.
The hook there, I believe, is that he is actually Judas Iscariot, who, because he was hanged himself at sundown. Yeah, you know,
I haven't seen it either, so.
It's yeah. Terrible. It's a pile of garbage. But the hook is, you know, he's Judas Iscariot, and he hanged himself at sundown, so he was never allowed to see the sun again. But he was also not allowed to die. And I think it's Christopher Plummer is Van Helsing. So again, kind of an interesting
Christopher
cast.
Plummer, huh? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. But there've been a couple of recent Dracula movies, one in 2013 and one in 2014. I have not seen, but I've heard they're terrible. One that is not terrible that I enjoyed a lot is Batman versus Dracula. It's one of those animated DC movies from the early 2000s that they did. I think they did a pretty decent job on, and it's kind of clever and creative and so on. The Renfield character in that is the Penguin, so it's
oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's pretty well done. They unfortunately don't get Mark Hamill in to voice the Joker, but other than that, it's a fun movie.
Okay. Coyle, I failed to mention, I mean, the big deviation, if you will, of the 1992 Dracula, and it really affects the plot, is that Dracula goes to London specifically to find Mina, right. And the reason is that, you know, this is a far more romanticized plot line in which, you know, the 15th century, you know, Vlad the Impaler, his wife gets a false report that he's been killed in battle and commits suicide. He, you know, renounces the faith and, you know, desecrates the church and is turned into the vampire. And then in the late 19th century, he sees a photograph that Jonathan Harker has of Mina and realizes that she is the reincarnation of Lizaveta, his bride from 500 years ago. So the plot is just completely different because he's not strictly a predator, but he is this romantic figure trying to reunite with his, you know, his lost love.
Which reminds me, there's a I'm sure you guys, as I did when I was growing up, watched the Hercules TV show, the Kevin Sorbo Legendary Journeys thing. One of the last episodes was Hercules versus Dracula.
No.
And it is exactly as spectacular as it sounds. It's worth looking at. It's like season 6 or something like that. It's worth watching.
Wow.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. They had a little half season that they had to fill because of some obscure New Zealand law based on their filming rights there. So they kind of filled it with everything. And one of them was Hercules versus Dracula. And it was a good one. Well, Jens, anything else to add on any of these subjects?
Wow, I think we've run a lot of the gamut here.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think we hit Christian Humanist length. I think we're still at City of Man length. Sorry, guys.
That's all right.
Well,
but at least we haven't gotten into sectarian review territory.
Well, that's true. This will not be a two-part episode. Let me close this out. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out other podcasts in our family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find the show. You can also like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of the absent Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.